Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wall Street's keeping its fingers crossed, hoping for an economic Christmas miracle. And there's always a chance, I suppose. But odds are it's going to be a lump of economic coal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Pandemic flu is a real threat, but there are steps you can take to prepare. More information at takethelead.pandemicflu.gov. And by U.S. Trust, Bank of America Private Wealth Management, committed to understanding the values that truly matter to clients and offering a personal approach to managing their wealth.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizal. It is the 17th of December today. Good to have you with us. And there are two things of note to start us off on this Monday, items that might help you put both the economy and the holidays into a little bit of context. First of all, when was the last time you heard this phrase? Mergers and acquisitions. Yeah, that's what I thought. It's been a while, right? Deals have been scarce in this time of tight credit, but there were some slight glimmers of hope this morning on that front. The biggest of the bunch was Ingersoll Rand. It's going to buy the air conditioning company Trane in a deal that comes in at just over $10 billion. No, not a staggering sum, but big enough to raise hopes that better days are ahead somehow. Item number two, retail shoppers. With only 7 shopping days left until you-know-what, sales aren't living up to expectations, and they weren't even expected to be that good. Retail management, however, is on a buying spree. Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
Executives at retail firms like The Limited, Foot Locker, and Dillard's are snatching up their own company's shares. Since November, they've increased their collective stake by $350 million.
This is very unusual based on recent history that insiders would be pouring this much money in this sector.
That's Ben Silverman with Insider Score, a firm that tracks executive transactions. Retail stocks have taken a beating this year. The industry is heading for its biggest decline in 5 years. So what do retail executives know that we don't?
Perhaps they feel that the retail sector is not as bad as the doomsayers believe it is. Insiders in retail and typically across the stock universe have been very good at calling lows.
The last 4 times retail insiders added to their holdings, stock prices rebounded by 10% in the next 3 months. So many retail analysts see insider activity as a good sign. Not investment banker Howard Davidowitz.
I think the worst is yet to come, not only on Main Street, but on Wall Street. We're going into a recession next year led by the devastation of the American consumer, which we see in the current retail numbers.
Davidowitz says executives by their nature are bullish on their own stocks, which he predicts will continue to get hammered. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Let's get back to that Ingersoll Rand deal we started with for just a second here. Economists like to use buyout activity to help measure economic growth. It is just one gauge among many, to be sure, but deal watchers have been as spooked as anybody by the credit crunch, which is why today's news is raising hopes. Not a dime of the $10 billion that Ingersoll is going to spend came from private equity. Those firms have financed most of the buyouts that have happened so far this year, but now companies with cash in hand are paying for their own deals. From New York, Marketplace's Jill Barshay reports.
Private equity firms were almost this year's buyout kings. They raised tons of cash in the debt markets and outbid everyone else to take over businesses. Steve Miller is a managing director at Standard & Poor's Leverage Commentary and Data. He says the August credit crunch stopped that merry-go-round.
That it's been much harder for private equity firms to source and finance deals, but it has created an opportunity for corporate buyers.
Miller says companies are hungry to grow. They've been stockpiling cash after years of double-digit earnings, and they can use their stock shares as money. Greg Feinstein is one of the heads of mergers and acquisitions at Houlihan Lokey. Feinstein says his investment bank is involved in 180 buyouts now.
It is a shift from the leveraged buyout firms that are buying it as a purely financial transaction into operating companies who are acquiring it because it's an expansion of what they're doing.
Feinstein says all this new M&A activity shows not all business leaders are worried about a recession.
If a CEO is worried about the economy, he won't expand, he won't spend money. So having a high level of certainty and confidence about the future is really the most important thing for M&A.
Feinstein doesn't expect companies to buy as much or as quickly as the private equity guys did. But both he and Miller predict we'll see some big-ticket purchases in 2008. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
We'll get some inkling of how troubled Wall Street has really been by the subprime crunch starting tomorrow. Goldman Sachs reports earnings Tuesday. Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns follow Wednesday and Thursday. In the Senate today, lawmakers continued their debate of the rules governing electronic surveillance. The bill at hand would allow warrantless wiretaps of calls or emails coming from somebody overseas to somebody here in the United States. The sticking point, though, is whether telecommunications companies should be immune from lawsuits over their cooperation with the government in those searches, immune going as far back as September 11, 2001. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
President Bush says he'll veto any bill that doesn't provide liability immunity for telecom companies. Last month, the House passed a bill without immunity, but Senate Democrats have been unable to come up with the 60 votes to approve the House version. The president's supporters in the Senate, like Missouri Republican Christopher Bond, say the government depends on phone company records to track down terrorists.
Companies in the future may be less willing to assist the government if they face the threat of private lawsuits each time they are alleged to have provided assistance.
But Massachusetts Democrat Edward Kennedy said he doesn't buy the administration's argument that lawsuits would bankrupt the telecom companies.
In other words, the administration is telling us that these companies may have engaged in lawbreaking on a scale so massive that they could not afford the penalty if they are brought to justice. But massive lawbreaking is an argument against immunity, not for it.
California Democrat Dianne Feinstein has introduced a compromise to require a court review of the immunity question. She thinks the companies would have a good argument.
There is a long-standing common law provision that allows citizens to rely on the assumption that the government acted legally when it asked a private citizen or a company to assist it for the common good.
Telephone companies that allegedly turned over their records to the government are facing some 40 lawsuits from groups and individuals who say their privacy was violated. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The president weighed in on the economy today. It's good. That's about the gist of it. Wall Street sees things differently, though. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a chance of rain in Atlanta, Georgia on Christmas Day. That is not ordinarily something locals would be pleased with, I'm sure. But the persistent drought in the southeast will probably make a rain shower or two a welcome present. The governors of Georgia, Florida, and Alabama held a meeting in Florida today trying to resolve their fight over ever shorter water supplies. There was no hard progress to report, but they did announce that they'll meet again in mid-February, and they have promised to make peace by then. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser explains how things got so bad.
Water is everyone's lifeblood. It nourishes crops, livestock, and people. Now, states that once took it for granted are parched. Northern Georgia never built its own state reservoir system and is now suffering through its worst drought in at least 20 years. Critics say Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue still doesn't have a plan. Instead, he prayed for rain in a highly publicized outdoor service.
God, we need you. We need rain. Thank you, Lord, for the rain to come. Amen.
The rains did come. Of course, the governor's timing was fortuitous. Showers were in the forecast. The rain didn't put a dent in the drought, though, and Georgia hasn't put mandatory restrictions on big water users like Coca-Cola bottling plants. The state has limited the amount of water that consumers can use in the Atlanta area. In September, Georgia banned outdoor watering. Hotlines were set up so people could tattle on their neighbors.
They had a hose running the whole time, and I think it's a gross violation.
They are watering the front entrance every morning.
The water was running into the street. The sprinklers were going.
Georgia's problems have spilled over into Alabama and Florida. Georgia's Lake Lanier Reservoir feeds the rivers that flow to Georgia's neighbors. The reservoir is also Atlanta's prime water source. The Army Corps of Engineers controls how much reservoir water flows downstream. Georgia says the Corps is releasing too much. Alabama and Florida want more. It's a food fight over water.
Everybody has lawsuits against everybody else.
Chick Krautler heads the Atlanta Regional Commission, the city planning agency in charge of water use.
There are five different lawsuits in four different courts that are all very complicated, and none of them are making any progress.
Georgia says it has to balance water restrictions with the needs of Atlanta's growing population and booming economy. But Alabama argues it needs water for the Farley nuclear power plant. On one day in September, 44,000 gallons of water per minute from the Chattahoochee River cycled through the plant. Downstream, oysterman Johnny Richards has worked Florida's Apalachicola Bay for more than 50 years. He says he's hauling fewer oysters onto his boat this year.
The fresh water coming down is like blood in our bodies. It's coming down the bay to sustain life in the bay, not only oysters, fish, crabs, shrimp. Depends on the river flow. Without the fresh water, our bay will die.
When the balance of salinity to fresh water gets out of whack, oyster predators thrive. The Sunshine State needs fresh water for both wildlife and tourism, and it's aggressively protected its water resources. It doesn't allow developers to build until they prove there's enough water for new houses. But the state is still vulnerable when it comes to a lack of planning by neighbors like Georgia. Judith Curry of the Georgia Institute of Technology says other states need to learn from Georgia's mistakes.
I hope this serves as a wake-up call that each state needs to have a good plan and that there is a need for some federal involvement in order to deal with these interstate wars that are inevitable.
Curry expects the next water wars to break out among other southeastern states more used to hurricanes than drought. Usually lush Virginia and North Carolina are dry right now. One town in Tennessee is so parched its mayor is trucking in water. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Water is the subject of author and photographer Rick Smolin's latest project, both the lack of it and how so much of the H2O that we do have is polluted and unusable. The book is called Blue Planet Run. It's a big coffee table thing, just like his earlier projects that I'm sure you've seen, documenting a day in the life. Rick, it's good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
This is an interesting book because it's about a thing, of course, it's about water, but really it's the concept of scarcity.
In the course of doing this book, I learned a lot of things I knew nothing about. And one was that the amount of water on our planet right now is exactly the same as it was, fresh water for us to drink, same amount of water that was here when the dinosaurs inhabited the Earth. So now we have 6.5 billion people all trying to drink the same finite amount of water. It's about 3% of the water on the Earth is drinkable for human beings.
This could well be the title page of this book. It's two kids walking on what looks to be a huge water pipeline someplace in India. Tell us about this photograph.
Well, the photograph's taken in Mumbai, which is one of the largest cities in India. It used to be called Bombay. It turns out that they have these enormous, massive water pipes that feed water to the more affluent members of Indian society. But what you're seeing here is people that live on the margins, on the fringes of that population. And it looks like they're literally living in a garbage dump. And in fact, the way that they get around to not be walking in the garbage is they walk over these pipes.
Is this the worst of it, these kids walking on this pipeline in the midst of all this refuse in Mumbai?
The funny thing, Kai, is that the it is different in different places. In some places, we're sucking water out of the ground now around the world at four times the rate it's going back into the ground. So these aquifers, which are like underground rivers that where most of the clean water is around the world, or fresh water, we're actually pulling the water out so fast that the water table is dropping, which makes the ground above it porous. So in some places like Kansas City and Mexico City, the ground is starting to crumble.
Let me get you to the next picture. Flip over there and the copy of it that you had. And I think what we have here is a representation of people getting water off Kenya, right off Nairobi.
That's right. What you're looking at is a picture. It looks almost like somebody's taken a stick and poked it into the ground, except then you realize you're actually looking down at human beings around these holes. And they all have water buckets, and they're desperately digging for water. And this is a scene that's going on now all over Africa and in many places in the developing world in particular. The statistic that we learned is that human beings in Africa are spending 40 billion hours finding and carting water back to their families.
This last picture caught my eye because it seems so incongruous. It is it's in Austria, I think, right? And these guys are up on a glacier rolling what looks to be some kind of thermal blanket over these glaciers up in the Alps.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me of sticking your finger in the dike. I mean, the level, there's a whole chapter in the back of the book which is called A Billion Slingshots, and it's all these fascinating, some seem to be absurd, some to be absolutely amazingly clever. Ways that human beings, it's almost like the world's antibody system is starting to kick in as people are starting to become aware of the extent of the water crisis. You mentioned in the Alps where they're desperately trying to wrap glaciers to keep them from melting because they get all their drinking water from it. One of the pictures that I am the most fond of in the book is something in the back called fog catchers. A group of Canadian scientists came up with this idea of putting up these huge, they look like huge sheets of mesh. In places like Nepal, where they have a very thick ground fog but no groundwater, it actually extracts the water from the fog, and it sort of coagulates and then goes into these cisterns.
You have said you're hopeful after completing this book, and I have to tell you, after I finished going through it, it was fairly depressing.
Well, the thing that makes me hopeful is that the last chapter of the book, The Billion Slingshots chapter, shows a remarkable amount of innovation being applied to it.
You know, Rick Smolin best by his day in the life books. His latest work is called Blue Planet Run, about water on this planet. Rick, thanks a lot for coming by.
Thanks, Kai.
I should say we'll have pictures from the book, the ones we talked about anyway, on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, entrepreneurs weigh the big bucks of a buyout against going it alone.
In the end, we as sole owners of our company have more freedom to do it however we want to do it.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial shed 172 points today, 1.3% to end at 13,167. The Nasdaq sliced off 61 points, 2.3% to finish at 2574. The S&P 500 lost 22 points, 1.5% to close at 1445. Casualties included companies from earth movers to internet and technology shakers. Caterpillar dumped 3%. eBay stumbled 2.5%. Amazon fizzled 4.5%. Apple lost more than 3% of its polish. Micron Technology, the giant producer of memory chips, lost a macro 5.75% today. Research in Motion of BlackBerry renown threw off 5.4%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note sank to 4.14% today. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Sustainability Fund of the Tides Foundation, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet. Each song we choose for the rundown on Marketplace is there for a reason. If you hear one that resonates, you can find out what it is on our website. Head to marketplace.org and check out the songs on the right side of the screen. There's also a link to an online store where you can buy each song.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on new home construction for November. A Senate committee discusses ways of allocating resources toward preventing oil spills. And it's International Migrants Day. The United Nations estimates that one in every 35 persons in the world is a migrant, living and working in a country other than his or her own. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know what this says about what American women can expect come Christmas morning, but sales of women's clothing is down about 6% so far this holiday season. The report from MasterCard Advisors, those are based on credit card receipts, cites boring fashions as one of the reasons. Commentator Sandra Singh Lo says her recent shopping spree was anything but dull.
We have come to the point in 21st century American civilization where the cosmetic improvements available to us actually outstrip our bodies. For instance, a few years ago, I decided to get my four front teeth recapped. The dentist asks me to pick a new shade, but I'm thinking, how often am I going to do this? If I buy myself that Scotch Extra White now, it'll give me some insurance against all that future coffee, tea, and red wine. So it comes shortly to pass that I meet Peter Mayle, author of A Year in Provence. I had just written A Year in Van Nuys, and long story short, Mayle and I are in studio doing a kind of witty World Wrestling Federation smackdown of Provence versus Van Nuys. We satirically traded increasingly heated accusations of elitism, affluence, and artificiality, at which point Peter Mayle literally hurls out something like, "Well, for goodness sakes, look at your teeth!" If a British person finds your teeth too white, that may be a good thing, but still, I felt I overshot. So last week, I go to Victoria's Secret to get some new bras. I hate bra shopping, so I always just get the front bra, be it the T-shirt bra, angel bra, wonder bra, miracle bra, or as I like to say, the four horsemen of the apocalypse bra. I don the bra the next morning and realize I can't go out in public. This bra is as terrifying as a bioengineered catfish that eats all other wildlife. These are basketballs grafted onto the chest about a foot higher than the natural bust area. They're up around the neck, but I have to say, surprisingly comfortable. Singed by Peter Mayle, though, I thought if I wore the bra into work, I'd better announce it. So I enter the radio station, throw up my arms, and yell, "Look at my giant bra!" And the 40-something male engineer practically begins crying. And henceforth around the studio, it became known as Victoria's most poorly kept secret.
Sandra Singh Lo lives here in Los Angeles. Take a second to send us your thoughts. Our website is marketplace.org. We've spent the past few Mondays with Steve Tripoli from our entrepreneurship desk, getting to know more about a special breed of startup enterprises, social entrepreneurs who use their businesses to try to fix what might be wrong with the world. As with less high-minded ventures, you'd think bigger would be better, that more profits would allow for more good to be done. And maybe that's true, but when mission-oriented businesses get big enough, they also attract serious buyers. There's no doubt that cashing out can mean a big payday. But does it also mean selling out? Here's Steve.
There's this point many businesses reach when they get to around, say, $30 or $40 million in annual sales. Copycats show up and people flashing money, all while the founders juggle fast growth and maybe the suspicion that they're not the ones to carry things forward. In the spring of 2000, Gary Erickson was at that point. Machines like this one at his Clif Bar factory near Los Angeles were already wrapping tens of millions of nutrition bars a year back then. And he and a partner were looking at a $120 million buyout offer from the Mars Candy people. Two competitors had already sold out to multinationals. Erickson says friends were urging him to take the offer in language this avid cyclist could relate to.
What people were saying was, you know, your ride's over. The larger companies are going to kill you. You're going to be marginalized. They're going to buy you off the shelf. You're not going to be able to compete against multi-million dollar advertising campaigns.
Erickson was worn out. He was kind of an accidental social entrepreneur to start with. Clif Bars came out of his cyclist's desire to have something more wholesome to eat while riding. The company became a hit around themes of good food, good worker policies, and a light environmental footprint. But now Erickson was buying into some of his friends' doubts.
I was just a bike rider, and, you know, I started this company on an idea. And I think the doubt was, can we do it? Can we take it from here without bringing in some kind of expert help, either financial or corporate or a large company? And I think that's pretty natural for someone in our position to wonder.
But minutes from a $60 million payday, Erickson walked away from the deal. He says he and his co-owner wife didn't want to find themselves asking this question when he's heard from other entrepreneurs who cashed out.
You know, I wonder if I could have pulled it off. And we didn't want to wonder.
There's another thing Erickson and his wife Kit never have to wonder about by keeping the company, whether its founding mission is intact. Both seem anxious to explain what that means to them.
In the end, we as sole owners of our company have more freedom to do it however we want to do it. That's the kind of freedom we wanted, and that's why we took the huge gamble to keep the company private.
Yeah, don't want
to
watch.
If we ever had to talk to a board of directors that was controlling the company, you might as well just start passing me the razor blades now.
Other social entrepreneurs say they sell out to corporations to save their brands, expand their missions, or change the way big companies think. Gary and Kit say they're not afraid of failing, and Gary questions other entrepreneurs' stated reasons for selling.
I've heard that line many times. We're going to do more for the community. We're going to do more for the earth. We're going to do more for our brands because now we can leverage all the power of this large company and blah, blah, blah. And I don't know if that's always the truth.
Even if that's what others think will happen when they sell, it often doesn't work out that way. The British watchdog group Ethical Consumer says there's little evidence companies with strong social missions influence their buyers. It rates most socially conscious firms that get taken over as worse on social issues after they sell out. That includes Ben & Jerry's ice cream, Body Shop Cosmetics, and Toms of Maine personal care products. Gary Erickson says the reason for that is obvious.
The people that were formerly founders and running the company are just a clear fact. They're not running the company anymore.
But even the ethical consumer watchdogs haven't given up on these firms changing their new parents. They say that as good products get to bigger markets and consumers become more aware, there may be a tipping point. But for now, the group says it's still best to change corporate behavior from outside. That might even be the more profitable path. Gary Erickson says that shortly after he turned down the Mars buyout, he made a big move into organic ingredients without raising prices. He says it was a risky hit to the bottom line that a corporate parent might not have tolerated. But the move paid off. Clif Bar grabbed more market share, and today it's a $100 million business. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a well-thought-out allocation strategy can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, the blog celebrates an anniversary today. 10 years ago, a guy named Jorn Barger coined the term weblog to describe his website, Robot Wisdom, it was called. It was shortened to blog 2 years later. Back then, only about 23 websites were properly considered blogs. These days, whether you write them or you read them, the blog is a pretty common pursuit. Estimates are that 120,000 new ones are created every single day. No word on how many of those are actually read, though. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shook off 172 points, 1.3%. The Nasdaq fell 61 points, 2.3%. The S&P 500 lost 22 points. That's a percent and a half there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Jennifer Collins, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the program, running a business on bisque and broth.
Every culture, soup is one of the oldest foods they have. After they would slay the woolly mammoth, they would boil the bones and make soup.
It's another conversation from the corner office, Campbell's Soup, this time. I'm Kai Rizdahl, and I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.